Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Victoria Thorpe, sitting in for Lauren Meltzer and Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is Title IX, creating champions and controversy for 40 years. 2012 marks the 40th anniversary of Title IX, the groundbreaking legislation that guaranteed no person could, on the basis of sex, be denied participation in any education program or activity that receives federal assistance. In the years since Title IX passed, the law has had an enormous impact on women and girls, particularly in high school and college athletics. According to one study, there has been a 450% increase in the number of women in college athletics over the past 40 years. The 2012 London Olympics also showed the strength of female athletes in the United States, as women constituted over half the team and won 56% of all medals earned by American athletes. However, Title IX has also created controversy and confusion. Some people claim the law enforces equal quotas for men and women in college athletics that have required schools to eliminate male sports teams. And despite the progress that has been made since 1972, gaps still remain for women and girls to reach equity. In high schools, for example, studies have shown that nationally there are about 1.3 million fewer chances for girls to play sports than boys. Here in the Bay Area, we have some of the nation's most successful women college athletes at places like Stanford and UC Berkeley, along with nonprofits that are working to extend the legacy of Title IX to the next generation of young girls. Tonight, City Visions will explore the impact of Title IX and how it has made a difference for women and girls in the Bay Area and across the United States. We will look at the concerns about Title IX that caused the law to be a continued source of tension. And finally, we will consider how we can reach the broader vision for Title IX, which includes the opportunity for girls and women to participate equally in all education programs, such as science, math, and engineering. And now I'd like to introduce our guests this evening. Joining me tonight in the studio are three Bay Area guests who each have a unique perspective on the impact of Title IX. Marlene Bornsrud is the co-founder and executive director of the Bay Area Women's Sports Initiative, which has an awesome acronym, BOSSY. BOSSY mobilizes female athletes to improve the world and has inspired more than 13,000 young girls from around the Bay Area to love physical activity through volunteer work by over 2,000 women athletes. Marlene's career over the past 35 years has included leadership roles in both sports management and nonprofit work. In 2005, Marlene founded BOSSY with former Olympic and World Cup soccer stars Brandi Chastain and Julie Foudy. Welcome, Marlene.
Thank you.
Carrie Dew is the athletic engagement coordinator at BOSSY. Carrie attended the University of Notre Dame on a soccer scholarship. After graduating in 2009, she was drafted to play in the newly formed Women's Professional Soccer League by Bay Area team FC Gold Pride. Carrie spent 2 years with FC Gold Pride and a third with Sky Blue FC in New Jersey before the league collapsed earlier this year. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Kristen is a senior staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center in San Francisco and the director of the center's Fair Play for Girls in Sports project. Elizabeth has worked at the center since 2002 and has litigated numerous cases involving Title IX athletics at the high school level. Elizabeth has been a lecturer at Berkeley Law School since fall 2008 and also served as a law clerk for the Honorable James R. Browning on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Roger Blake, who is the executive director of the California Interscholastic Federation, which governs interscholastic athletics, promoting equity, quality, character, and academic development across California. Roger has been involved in education for almost 36 years as a teacher, coach, administrator, athletic director, and more. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being part of City Visions Radio tonight. At about 20 minutes after the hour, we'll start taking calls from our listeners at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or send us a message on our Facebook page. All right, I'm going to start tonight. I'd like to go back and look a little bit at the history of Title IX because there's a lot of things that people don't really know about it. And one of the most important things I learned is that there was nothing in the original law that ever mentioned athletics, yet that's become really the focal point of its implementation. So maybe, Elizabeth, you could start us off by just giving us some of the background, giving our listeners some of the background about Title IX and why was the law passed. Interestingly, it's connected to the Civil Rights Act of 1965, so maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. And what was the original intent of the law?
The law was passed in 1972, and it was a law that was brought about actually because of discrimination in academia. The godmother of Title IX, a woman named Bunny Sandler, was somebody who was not able to get an academic job and had begun challenging the discrimination against women in the professional fields. And so she really was a moving force behind getting Title IX passed. And so there was a very simple law passed, which was that there shouldn't be discrimination on account of sex in educational institutions. But at the time, people didn't really have athletics in mind. And over the years, athletics has certainly become a critical component of Title IX. In fact, the word Title IX has almost become synonymous with sports. But it's had also a profound impact in a number of other fields. For example, when I went to law school, and I started at UC Berkeley in 1998, over half my law school class was women. But my mom also went to law school in the early 70s, and she was one of only 10 women in her law school class. So it had a dramatic impact in terms of opening doors to professional fields for women as well.
Yeah, it's got such an incredible legacy in all these ways that people don't realize. How did athletics become such a central part of the law's implementation over the years?
I think as soon as girls and young women started to know about Title IX and started to know that they might have a chance to play sports, there was just this real natural inclination to want to participate. I know that's what I had when I was a young girl. I learned about Title IX. I was in third grade. I heard about a boys' basketball team at my school, and I asked my mom, wait a second, why can't I play? I thought there was supposed to be equality for girls. And so I became the only girl playing on my boys' basketball team. Mm. And I think that was a story that was repeated across the country. If you talk to women of almost any age, you will find that they have a passion for participating in sports or watching sports, or they wish that they had been able to play sports. And so I just think that there was this pent-up demand and interest in sports that really was unleashed by Title IX.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's so important. I wanted to talk a little bit about the impact of Title IX, particularly at college. And Marlene, I'm going to start with you because you've been a college coach, athletic coach, and have been working with all these college athletes through the years. And I'd love to hear you maybe describe, and Carrie, we'll get to you next maybe, but a little bit about how you see things, what's changed as a result of Title IX for female athletes today compared to 40 years ago. I mean, obviously you weren't working 40 years ago, but in your as you look across the landscape of how things have changed?
Well, I think there's been some significant change in really positive ways. When I began coaching a college tennis team in the early 1970s, Title IX had been passed but hadn't been implemented on many campuses. So, for example, my first year as a tennis coach, our women's team had to raise money to buy uniforms. While the men's basketball team, the men's coach made an ordering a mathematical error in his order of purchasing jock straps and mistakenly ordered 144 dozen while we were raising the money to buy our uniforms. And that was acceptable. He had no limit on scholarships, and I had one scholarship. So we played, and I coached for the love of the game, and because I believe so deeply that sports was part of the educational process. I think we've moved fast forward now to 2012, where there are many more opportunities for women. Across the board, there is not still, in many cases, the equity level is still very, very different. But women are seizing those participation opportunities as fast as schools can offer them and really making the most of them. Women athletes know that it's not about playing their sport that's going to open doors to make a living playing that sport. Those opportunities just aren't there and aren't sustained yet for women to make a living as an athlete in most cases. But they're playing those sports and taking that opportunity to get degrees, to turn professional in something else. And I just feel, as I look back as kind of a pioneer in this area, I'm so pleased that women have used those athletic scholarships as a way to get an education, which was exactly what they were designed to do.
That's so interesting. One of the things I read along the ways of doing research for the show was about how somewhere I saw that something like 80% of the women that were surveyed by Fortune magazine or Forbes had a a college sports background. So that the leadership experience that these women athletes are getting in college is a real confidence booster and opens up a lot of doors in many ways that you can probably never even see when you're just on the playing field or in the basketball court or that sort of thing. So, Carrie, I'd love to hear from you next, who's actually had both a professional women's sports experience, which is so wonderful, and then played college soccer at a very renowned and very well-known sports school, Notre Dame. So I'd love to know what your experience was as a college athlete at such a big school, playing for such a highly ranked team. And, you know, did you feel on par with the football players? And, you know, what was it like to be in your shoes as a very recent college graduate?
Well, I had an amazing experience at Notre Dame, and I'm so thankful that I was able to play soccer there and be a part of the athletic family there. And I felt like there was so much support across the board from all the males teams, all the female teams, just in general, everyone supporting each other. And I think the football team was the one team at the school that was sort of on its own level and maybe had a different standard. But other than that, I never felt like there was something I couldn't do or that I was discouraged to do. And I loved every minute of it.
It's a neat opportunity. And what was it like to then go play professional women's soccer?
That was amazing as well. Mm-hmm. And when I started playing when I was 5 years old, and that was always something I dreamed of doing. And it was three of the best years of my life, for sure. But it's equally disappointing when, you know, you think you're taking so many steps forward, and then the league just folds completely. So it is disappointing, but I really enjoyed my time doing it.
We'll have a separate show about women's soccer and why we can get a league to sustain itself. Roger, I'd like to bring you in now. Are you there on our line there, Roger?
I'm honored to be with these unbelievable women. Dave. I wish I was there. I'd be getting some autographs.
Okay. Roger's in Sacramento is the only reason he's not with us. Title IX applies to both high schools and colleges, as I think most people know. And one thing I did read somewhere that, you know, the number of girls participating in high school sports has increased by, some people say, 900% since 1972. So it's had an amazing impact. But there seems like there's still some progress to be made before girls have full equity and parity with boys in high school athletics.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'd love to hear your perspective on how you see the landscape of girls' sports in California in terms of compliance with Title IX, and where, you know, if you were to describe where the progress is and where the gaps still are.
Well, the progress is the same as been mentioned. It's the number of kids that are participating. I pulled out some old numbers to look up in preparation for this call. And in 1967, by the statistics that we were keeping at that time, there was very few high school sports available for young girls. And the numbers that we had reported at that time was 54,000 girls participating in 1967. In 1972, it jumped to 86,000. Now we're over 308,000 girls this past year. So, you know, I think Marlene said it earlier, you know, the kids are playing for the love of the game, and gender doesn't impact that at all. I mean, kids participate because it's fun, and they love to play. The areas where we still, I think, especially at the high school level, still have to increase opportunities and make gains is sometimes with the decision makers, that, you know, that the field of dreams story, if you build it, they'll come. And if Title IX's proven anything to any naysayers over the years, if you provide opportunities, they'll come. The young women playing in my high schools across the state of California today, they don't know what happened back in 1950 and 60 and 70. They see that opportunity. They want to participate. They want to play. And the struggle we still have to do is at the high school level is opportunities is one. And then the second one, I think, unfortunately, the one that Elizabeth has to deal with sometimes with some of our schools and districts is the lack of equal facilities for the kids. The boys' baseball field may look like AT&T Park, and the softball field is not taken care of and not maintained. And, you know, that's probably one of our biggest issues that we see with our schools, that they just they're doing some things really nicely for the boys, and they're not doing those same things and providing those opportunities and benefits for the girls.
That's really interesting. I'm going to ask Elizabeth to come in now because I know you've litigated a couple of cases that really tried to address some disparities in facilities for girls' athletics. And I would think it would be helpful for listeners to understand what that looks like and how hard it is for these girls to actually come forward and make their case and stick with it for the amount of time it takes to get that thing all the way through court.
That's right. It's been very challenging for our plaintiffs, and they've been some incredibly brave young women. I mean, think about being a high school student and coming forward to complain about inequality at your school, and then being a plaintiff in a lawsuit and suing your school. It's been very difficult, and unfortunately, our girls have also been subjected to retaliation. And so I've pursued two different cases, both in Southern California, one against the Alhambra High School and one against Castle Park High School, which is in Chula Vista, California, just south of San Diego. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the Castle Park case because I think it's particularly instructive for people. We were contacted in that case by a dad, and we often find that the fathers of female athletes are particularly enraged when they find out what the conditions are for their daughters. And he called us and he said, the softball field my girls are playing on is terrible. And I look over and the baseball field is really nice and pristine. And I tried to talk to the athletic director, and in response, he threatened to fire the softball coach. And so when we began pursuing this claim, that's exactly what the school did. They fired the softball coach, and it was retaliation against the girls. And the school has fought us every step of the way. We originally contacted them and said, hey, there's some inequalities here. You know, why don't you fix them? They acknowledged that there was inequalities. And instead of fixing them, they've been fighting this case since 2007, even appealing it now to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco. So they've basically been fighting instead of solving the problems. But what we find when we see high school inequalities, a lot of times softball, baseball disparities are sort of the window into the school, because that's often where you can see the biggest disparities between girls and boys. But those are usually emblematic of deeper problems. And what we find is that if there's disparities in those kinds of facilities, there often are also disparities in participation opportunities for girls, meaning that they're not getting the number of opportunities to play as they should. And then we often also find retaliation when girls raise complaints. So we unfortunately have a serious problem here in California at our high schools. And, you know, one other issue that we haven't talked about yet is that it's often low-income girls and girls of color who are being most left behind with respect to Title IX. And so we're out there fighting for those girls.
Who already probably face tremendous resource challenges as it is.
Absolutely.
So, Roger, I think it'd be interesting, since you work with all these coaches and athletic directors around the state, maybe you could just give us a lens on what do you think the blocks are for people? I mean, why would a school district not just comply? It's got to be much more expensive and difficult and time-consuming to be in court for 5 years than it is just to buckle down and fix the athletic field, right?
No, oh, absolutely. And Elizabeth hit it on the note. They don't want to sue a school. They don't want to spend all that time and resources and money to going to court. I mean, in all the cases that I've been involved with, they've always stepped out. The plaintiffs have always said, here's the problem. Let's work together and fix this. The obstacle that we're always facing is the decision makers on the other side of the table, sometimes a school principal, a superintendent, or even district board members that just might not understand what the real issues here. They're often misguided. They believe all the myths that they've read over the last 25 or 30 years. Sometimes, and I say this with all due respect to our older listeners, I'm one of them. Sometimes we have, you know, rules and regulations that were made 65 years ago by people that don't apply to the kids of today and the world that we live in yet. They want to hold on to this old-fashioned concept and idea that's purely outlived its time. So I think one of the biggest aspects that I've always worked with different groups is part of our job is try to bridge that gap, to educate those individuals on what Title IX really does mean and not to be threatened by it and to see how it's a positive thing for the kids on your campuses. The easiest thing, the simplest explanation when I run up against the wall with someone that has a old-fashioned belief system or thought is they all have children. We treat our sons and daughters. They have different needs and different desires, but we treat them the same. You know, and that's sometimes a hard concept for some people to understand. It. We still treat our boys and girls the same, regardless, that they do have different loves and different needs and beliefs. So that's really the biggest role that the CIF has tried to do over the last 10 years and that we continue to put on the forefront of the burner, because I'd like, and Elizabeth would like to be out of business. We'd like for her not to have to go litigate those things. And I can tell you with all sincerity, we work together anytime we can to try to solve the problem. She doesn't want to sue Castle Park High School. She'd love to have just, can we solve the problem? But sometimes the lawsuit and the legal action is the only thing that will ring the bell and get somebody's attention to make corrective mm-hmm. measures.
And I think it's important for listeners to know that Elizabeth is working for a nonprofit law center, and there's no there's nobody seeking compensation. It's not one of those situations. It's just about getting compliance. I want to make sure everyone understands that. I want to just take a quick moment to remind everyone that this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about Title IX and the impact it's had on women's sports and more with our guests. We have Roger Blake, Executive Director of the California Interscholastic Federation, Marlene Bornsrud, the co-founder of Bay Area Women's Sports Initiative, Carrie Drew, who is a former college and professional women's soccer player, Elizabeth Kristen, who's the senior staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center, and the director of the Fair Play for Girls in Sports Project. And it's now time to invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments. Are you an athlete who's been impacted by Title IX? Do you have an opinion about the law's impact in the Bay Area? We'd love to hear from you. The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post messages on our Facebook page. I'm going to talk next a little bit about some of the controversy around Title IX. I think Roger touched on it. We've sort of been going around it. I think it's really important to realize that, 80% of voters support Title IX. The concept of Title IX doesn't seem to be something people really have any issue with, but the devil's always in the details with these things. And I think without getting too technical, maybe I'll ask Elizabeth or Marlene, one of you, to kind of explain the whole three-prong test for compliance of Title IX. And it's one of those things that most listeners probably don't know about, but it seems to be where people really get stuck. Elizabeth, would you like to help us with that?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. That's one aspect of Title IX, and it has to do with whether a school is providing what are called equal participation opportunities to girls. And there's three different ways that there can be compliance. The first is proportionality. And what you basically do there is you look at the percentage of females enrolled in the school. At many schools, it's 50%. And then you look at the percentage of athletes that are female. And it should be about 50%. And if it is, you have perfect proportionality and you're in compliance with Title IX. If it isn't in perfect proportionality, say it's off by 1 or 2 percentage points, you then figure out how many athletes could be participating in sports if there were perfect proportionality. And that's going to differ depending on whether you're at a small school or a big school. But if that absolute number is enough to form a viable team, then you're not in compliance with the first prong of Title IX. And that's not the end of the story. You then continue on and look at whether the school is satisfying all the interest out there. And it could be that they can show that, hey, you know what, we've offered every single team, we've offered new opportunities, and this is all the interest that there is. In that case, even if there's not perfect proportionality, you can still comply with Title IX by satisfying all the interest. I have to say, I've never seen a school that's satisfying all the interest, but that's certainly a possibility under Title IX. And then the final prong of Title IX was essentially a safe harbor for schools from 1972 to say, all right, schools, you haven't had Title IX, and now you have to come into compliance. We're going to give you some time to basically add teams for girls. And if you can show that you have a history and continuing practice of expanding your program offering for women, even if you're not quite up to speed yet, you can still be in compliance with Title IX. But 40 years later, I haven't seen any schools that can show a history and continuing practice, because if you add a team and then cut two teams for women, that's not a history and continuing practice of program expansion. But these tests have been challenged as a quota, and the courts have said, no, this is not a quota. This is something that is a program of showing compliance for women. There's these three different ways of having schools comply. And in theory, there's a lot of flexibility for schools. Unfortunately, schools generally are not complying with any one of the three prongs.
And so why is it that people say there's a quota? Well, I mean, that's something you perpetually hear. And even, you know, I talking to people about doing the show, I had a couple people said to me, oh, you know, the thing about Title IX is it's all those quotas. Why does that come up over and over again? I don't know if, Marlene, you have an opinion about that. And I don't need your, you know, you can just give me your sense.
Well, I think it's an easy way to look at numbers. And, you know, the numbers can look like there's a formula that would say quota. The reality is that that Title IX simply requires schools to allocate participation opportunities in a non-discriminatory way. To me, it just simply makes sense that if your student body is 53% and women and 38% of the sports opportunities are held by women. It just simply is a way to say, here's the standard that you now need to at least show an effort to meeting the needs and the interest needs of those that underrepresented gender.
And so why would then a school say we had to cut men's wrestling to comply with Title IX? Because that seems then you would say, well, we had a strict number. We had too many men wrestlers, so we had to cut them.
I think often what happens is Title IX becomes a scapegoat for the decisions of an athletic department to usually prioritize football over every other sport. And so instead of looking at it as Title IX against wrestling, we really should be saying, why are so many resources being allocated to football? You know, football is a great sport. You can allocate some of your resources to that sport, but because it has so many participants and many schools carry so many men on the football team, way more than we'll ever play, that ends up eating up so many of the resources that then they cut what they call minor men's sports. And then they blame Title IX for that decision. When, as Marlene said, this is really just about trying to allocate resources and opportunities fairly and equally to a student body that in most institutions is about 50% women.
Mm-hmm. So, I'd love to hear from you, Roger, because I wanted to ask.
Well, because there was a big difference when people started figuring out how do we implement Title IX, how they did it at the high school ranks and how they did it at the collegiate ranks. At the collegiate ranks, it was purely a business decision. They looked at it and said, we have only this much money. We have to make these positions available for young women, so we're just going to cut the men out. And they made a business decision, and that's why it got just so blown out in the press about, well, we have to cut wrestling because of X, Y, and Z for the girls. On the high school side, high school sports aren't funded very well anyway in the public schools and even many of our private schools. But it was like having a new child. You don't get rid of the older child. You still have that pot, that little bit of whatever money you got, and you have to figure out how to spread it out well. Now, not all of our schools did it really well. But at the high school level, you didn't see or hear these stories of, well, we're cutting these boys' sports to create opportunities for girls. The collegiate level, they completely looked at it as a business and not as an educational opportunity for kids. And I think that's one big difference between how it was handled at the high school level and the collegiate level. It's not saying high schools handled it perfectly. But that's a major difference in how the two handled it.
Mm-hmm. Marlene?
Well, I think, you know, some of the statistics show that some collegiate athletic budgets allocate 80% of their funds to football and men's basketball, and 20% is left to split between everybody else. So I appreciate Roger's thought about how college sports has really looked at it as an entertainment industry. It's not, when it comes down to the amount of money that is invested by an institution into collegiate sports, it really becomes less and less a piece of the education component and more a piece of the entertainment component. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's fascinating to me that somehow the football side of the equation has allowed and perhaps even helped create this sense that it's all the women's fault. Mm-hmm. When in reality, no one wants to acknowledge the elephant in the room with the kind of money that's being invested in football, not always even having the revenue to cover what is paid. So there's an interesting, I think, flawed accounting system in college sports that says as long as you're a revenue sport, it doesn't matter if you bring in more than you spend, as long as you bring some money in.
I want to come back to football because I do think that is the elephant in the room for sure. We have a caller on the line. Do we have John from El Cerrito there?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Great program. It's very interesting. The idea of equality in sports for boys and girls seems like a no-brainer. However, I'm curious about what the opposition would say. And my question is, how come on this particular program there are no opponents? It seems like everyone on the show supports Title IX for girls, but there's no representative of the organized parents or academics or whomever who would argue against it. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, I'll speak to the second question. I did try and find someone who would be sort of an opponent. I did try and find potentially a wrestling coach, and that seems to be a sore spot in a lot of schools. And I was not successful in finding someone who was willing to come on the air. So that's the reason we don't have a big opponent at the table. I'm going to try and ask some of the hard questions to our folks here at the table since there isn't an opponent present for us. But maybe we'll come back to this football question, but who are the opponents? If you had to say, okay, these are the people out there that are really anti-Title IX and are kind of, you know, working behind the scenes to chip away at it where they can.
That's a great question, because I don't know that they would say publicly that they're anti-Title IX. I think there are athletic directors. I think there are presidents. And I'm again talking about the collegiate sports scene just always want to hang their hat on that one bowl game that's going to turn this huge profit for an institution. I think that there is a tendency to look at college sports simply as a business. And when it comes right down to dollars and revenue sport, even when you work in college athletics, nobody can figure out how to define sports other than football and men's basketball, because they'll say revenue sports versus non-revenue sports. All sorts of names and labels that really don't fit any of it. Nobody won't. I remember in college athletics saying, well, tell me what it really means to be a revenue sport just because you sell a few tickets. You're still not spending, you're spending more than you raise, more than you earn.
Well, let's look at a school like Notre Dame. I want to get Carrie into our conversation a little bit, because I have a family member who was a big sports guy, University of Florida. I mean, these are schools that sell out every game. People are tailgating every weekend. I mean, there's obviously money coming in the door. And, you know, I guess an argument could be made to say, why don't we treat those sports differently? Why do they have to be subject to the same, you know, requirement everybody else does? And I just wonder, you know, maybe having gone to a school like that and been part of an athletic department, but in a obviously very successful team, but a different profile of sport, did you ever have those conversations with people? Did you ever have, you know, that sense that, you know, well, we're lesser because we're not, you know, bringing in the millions of dollars every year?
I would say there are definitely times where we would feel that way. I didn't think that anything was taken away from our program because of that program, but there definitely was a sense of priority, maybe, to football. For us, it was a little bit beneficial. We played... our schedule was at the same time. We were both fall sports. So Friday night they would have pep rallies, and then our games would be right following the pep rally. So people would flock in from there right to our stands, and we would get great crowds. And then the football games would be the next day. So, I mean, you can say there were good and bad things about it, for sure.
And when you say, I don't mean to press you, because if you don't want have it specific, but I'm just wondering, when you said there's times you just felt of a different priority, is there an example in your mind when you think of that?
I would say even just little things like being in the training room or needing to see a doctor and or needing to see one of the head trainers, the priority would always be first to football. And it was like, even if you had a big game coming up, it didn't necessarily matter.
And I think that's significant. I mean, some people might not think that's significant, but you're an athlete just like everyone else. And it's interesting that, you know, things are ranked, you know. And I'm sure there's a lot of pressure from alumni and all kinds of other people to put that priority on the football team. Yeah, and here's another question. We have an email question along the same lines, and maybe this comes back to what you were talking about, Marlene, or Rod, or anyone who's got any specifics about this. Do these big football teams literally subsidize the women's programs? I mean, does anybody know what percentage of football teams bring in enough revenue? Because they are very expensive, as you were mentioning, Elizabeth, to run these programs, that they really do say, oh, well, we can allow our, you know, women's college, our women's soccer team to fly to a tournament versus take a bus or something. Like, do you know what the real what the reality of that is versus, again, the myth?
From what I've seen and heard, that there's very few football programs in the country, maybe a handful, where they're actually making money and subsidizing any of the other teams. That in most schools, they're not kind of net revenue gains because they're such expensive programs. And I don't know, Marlene, if you have any other statistics on that.
You know, at one point I heard 7 football programs actually net revenue.
That's a pretty small number.
Yeah, and this is Roger, and I've seen the same studies. The NCAA has done some studies at the Division I level for collegiate football. I think there's 98 programs playing. It's a handful that turn a profit. It's a prestige thing. It's the myth that's out there all the time that we're going to fund all of our other programs with this 100,000 people that show up at University of Michigan for that football game. But there's only a small handful of schools where that's absolutely true. It was said earlier, and you know, I know I'm beating the same drum, but it's a business decision that they're making, and it's about the entertainment dollar, and it's not necessarily about that dollar that's coming in through the ticket gate and the revenue there. They're hoping that they win that bowl game so that they can generate alumni donations to the universities and schools. So it's really a different animal. At the high school level, you know, our schools, they're elated if they get 1,000 people to show up to the football game. If Balboa's playing Lincoln over there in the city, you know, their moms and dads and friends and some student bodies there. But so at the high school level, you know, making money off of football, they all wish they were. It's just not part of the educational model. We wish we were making money off those.
I wonder in places like Texas, though, maybe there are high school teams that do. I mean, not at the level, obviously, of a major NCAA school, but...
Absolutely, and it's kind of a scary trend in the high schools, and it's starting. We see it in some of our schools here in California. They want to be those elite name schools, and they think that that's the way to, you know, fame and fortune, and... I would come back, and I don't know the numbers in Texas, but I would have the same question as that's been posed here with the NCAA Division I schools. We're pouring so much money into it. What's the return? You know, in business, they always call it the return on the investment. Well, what's the return on the investment? That I don't have an answer for you.
And I think people are sometimes naive about how much these programs cost.
Think some of it is just excessive spending. So why would a Division I collegiate football team for a home game on Saturday need to be bused off campus on Thursday afternoon after classes? They stay in hotels. They have all their meals catered until the Saturday game. They intentionally cocoon them so that they can be focused. And when you just think about how much that costs over the term of a season, that could fund a wrestling team.
Mm-hmm.
So some of it is excessive, that an NFL roster has significantly fewer men on their roster than a collegiate football team, because there are young men who are on full-ride scholarships. Simply, they will never play a minute of a game, but they're there to practice. And so to me, it's just the excess that is just scary and so totally out of whack.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, that if you dig into the details and you really look at how, where the money's going, how much of it is it really going to core activities that are important. I want to just take a moment to remind everyone that we're listening to City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the legacy and impact of Title IX with our guests. We have Marlene Bordensrud, from the co-founder of the Bay Area Women's Sports Initiative, Roger Blake, the executive director of California Interscholastic Federation, Carrie Dew, who is a former college and professional women's soccer player, and Elizabeth Kristen, senior staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center and director of the Fair Play for Girls in Sports Project. I'm going to go to one of our callers now. We have Mike from Berkeley. Mike, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Thank you so much for calling. Would you like to ask your question?
Yeah, first of all, I am a coach of all girls in high school in the East Bay, and here we just had the Olympics with more women competing than ever. I was just wondering about your guest's opinion on if ever it's going to get to the point that the women or the girls that come out of high school and college will get the respect and also the recognition of the men.
Great question. Anyone want to jump in on that one?
I'll jump in first. 29, we had, I think the United States won 43 gold medals. 29 were won by female athletes. And it was in the teens that those female athletes were from California. The pendulum's changing. Each generation of kids that are coming out, you know, when their parents, you said it earlier, the demands, that calls that Elizabeth gets now are from dad saying, wait a minute, my daughter's not getting it right. You know, it's not fair. I think the pendulum, as each generation, as these new parents start having their kids come through, their expectations and their demands are going to change. I think we will see professional women's soccer leagues sustainable here in the United States. It's just not there yet because it, as a nation sport, soccer's still relatively new for us. But it's going to come. Will it be on an equal basis with the men? Yep, I think it will. It's going to be time. But I think it'll be there because each generation of kids coming up, their expectations and demands are significantly different than the one before them.
I love the question Mike asked about the respect. When will the respect come? Because for the weeks of the Olympics, women were on television and spoken about on the news and in the newspapers on an equal level. I've made it a practice since the Olympics ended to read the San Jose Mercury News every day, and women are now totally invisible in the sports pages again. So the respect level after having the most successful Olympics in history for women athletes, and then to literally fall off the radar so quickly, to me is a lack of respect. And I don't understand that, and I'm not sure how that pendulum is going to swing, but it needs to do that. Mm-hmm. And it'll be because of good men choosing to coach women and of women choosing to coach women and being in their corner fighting that good fight.
Mike, how do you see it from where you sit as a coach? Where do you, your high school girls are obviously the, you know, they're the generation coming up under Title IX still and getting to see all these phenomenal female athletes at the Olympics. Do you think they see themselves as equal to the boys?
Well, they do. I mean, it's when you coach in an all-girls school, I mean, you're also in somewhat of a disadvantage because you go to matches, and I mean, I coach track and field and cross country, and you have to wait around. It's just they seem to understand it, but they don't seem to get the respect, like I said.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really good point. That's a hard thing to make happen. But I think that's what all these phenomenal girls and women are doing by bit by bit. So thank you so much for your call. We had a follow-up question from a caller who didn't stay on the line, but I think it was a good one to add. You know, that
we can talk about the men's wrestling coach being sort of, you know, bitter that his sport got cut because of Title IX, you know, supposedly because of Title IX, although we've talked about the complexity of that argument. But the point, I think, that is maybe missed in that is there are a lot of men's sports that really struggle because of the overshadowing of football as well as girls' sports, and that it's not just a problem that female athletes have on college campuses. And I don't know if, Carrie, you have any... You know, I don't know if you've ever felt like the boys, the men's soccer team at Notre Dame kind of had that feeling like we're doing great, but no one will ever know what we're doing here kind of thing.
I think that's definitely true. And I think not just the soccer team, but even the basketball teams and the hockey teams, and they started to have a lot more success during my 4 years towards the end. So it got a little bit better. But I think, you know, you're always... Football is in the limelight, and you're always in the shadow,
mm-hmm.
Especially at Notre Dame, where there's so much history with the football program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's such a historically important sport there. I want to give our phone number one more time. It's 415-841-4134, and that's 415-841-4134, and we really would love to hear you hear any questions or comments you have for us in the last 15 minutes of our show, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You know, I want to probe on one part of this three-pronged test that I think is really interesting, and it comes to the work that Bossy's doing, and obviously Carrie's involved in it too. But what, and clarify me if I've got this wrong, Elizabeth, but this, there's a part of it that's about matching interests to participation. And one study I looked at showed, you know, they looked at 14 high schools in San Jose, and just in those 14 high schools, there was 1,000 fewer spots for girls in sports teams than there were for boys. I mean, that's really just a little microcosm. It's 1,000 girls who aren't on the playing field on the basketball court. But what about somebody who would say, well, you know what? The girls just aren't that interested. It's the boys who want to play. And I know this is what Bossy's trying to do, is get this next generation of girls fired up, especially in low-income settings. So, you know, what do you say to that argument? And then maybe you can share a little bit about what Bossy's doing to kind of... So I'll let either one of you jump in, or Carrie, too. Or Roger, for that matter. Sorry, I wasn't trying to leave you out, Roger.
It's okay. It's okay.
You know, the AAUW San Jose branch has done a wonderful service to girls' sports in the high schools by just going out and asking those questions of the high schools and finding out, not as a police kind of activity, but just as an interest to see how girls, if girls are playing. One of the factors that we've seen in San Jose is that there are lots of young girls that are growing up in neighborhoods where girls don't play sports, either because there's an expense associated that the family can't absorb, or there's just culturally, it's just not acceptable for the girl to play, especially if there's a girl and a boy. The boy will play, the girl won't. And sometimes just neighborhoods aren't safe. So we're seeing oftentimes that the boys simply play anyway. It's just a part of life, and it's what they do, and it's what they're expected to do. And if you go on many elementary school campuses in San Jose, Redwood City, really anywhere in the Bay Area, oftentimes at recess you see the boys play and the girls sit. And for some reason, girls have kind of found that's just what they do, especially if they haven't had the resources to be join a team, put on a jersey, and get out there and gain that level of confidence. So that is what Bossy is doing. We're asking women athletes from all over the Bay Area to give a little bit of their time to go on to elementary school campuses where girls are still very impressionable. They, you know, a little girl can't turn on the TV and see athletes 24 hours a day who look like her. So we want the athletes to go into her world and be seen and be role models that are very authentic, and teach a little girl at least to love being physically active. One of the interesting things that's come out through the NCAA in the almost 200,000 women who are now playing collegiate sports in the NCAA, only 4% are Latina. Mm. And really for little, so many girls in California to not see athletes who look like them, that needs to change. And I think as that changes, then as young girls start playing, then they'll play in high school and we won't see those discrepancies any longer.
It's a really important statistic because our demographic in the Bay Area and California is so many Latina girls in school. And if they're not participating, then we're really going to have a struggle to ever get to parity. We have a caller from San Francisco has a question I think would be a great one for Carrie. Do we have Nick there?
Yeah.
Thank you for calling City Visions. Go right ahead.
No problem. My question is, sometimes I wonder if the issues of trying to keep Title IX going and moving forward and getting better, and I do think it's a lot better than when I was much younger, is there's a lack of professional sports after college. I mean, it kind of stops and dies on the vine in college. So, granted, WNBA accepted, but I think they've tried soccer and other sports, and I'm just wondering if that lack of ongoing potential makes a difference.
Well, Carrie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, having been part of a professional women's sports team, and then anyone else who wants to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is when you're in college or when you're growing up and you're thinking about what you want to do or what you want to be, if you don't see that that's a realistic opportunity for you, you're going to put your time and your resources into something else, whether it's your major or, you know, whatever you think your career will be after college. So when you don't have something to look at and someone to aspire to be like in those positions, I think it does make it tough.
Mm-hmm. You can't quite see the full pipeline of what the effort is going to take you. Yeah, it's a great question, Nick. Thank you so much for your call. So the thing I wanted to come back to is around this whole question of looking at that legacy of Title IX and the next generation. And when you think about, maybe it's looking at this sort of pipeline idea, but if you look at the full realization of Title IX as a vision, obviously you have to take it at all these different levels, but you know, when you look at encouraging high school sports, Roger, I don't know if you have thoughts on that question about why, you know, why that interest gap still exists in high school. And is there a way that, you know, is there something that the Scholastic Federation is doing to try and close that gap?
We do. It's disappointing when Vassy does a survey of schools. That's what of the kids in the schools, of what they want to do and what sports they want to be doing. That's what our schools should be doing, and that's what we're constantly sharing with them, surveys and how to do the survey. Because you don't know, California, and we've kind of hit on the edge of it, our changing demographics are unbelievable over the last 15 years. 15 years ago, soccer was not played by anyone in California, and now it's one of our fastest growing sports. But our schools and the leaders in their schools that have to make those decisions about which sports and what offerings, they don't know if they don't ask. And so again, you know, from our perspective at the CIF, we have to continually educate, because that's, to me, that's the biggest gap. Because when people start to understand how to try to bridge these gaps and that there's really easy tools to do it and find out, they most often they'll take the steps. I think what stops them and prohibits them sometimes is they're fearful. They go, well, if I do the survey, does that mean I'm going to have to add boys or girls lacrosse? And there's only five kids that want to play, and you have to help tell them, no, that five kids is not an interest. Now, if you have 25, you've got enough for a team, and now you really should be looking at that. From an academic educational standpoint, we try to tell principals and school leaders, you just don't offer five periods of chemistry. You survey your kids and see how many kids and your teachers, how many kids are ready to progress up to chemistry. They have to do the same thing with their sports teams, and they just seem that it's one of the areas our schools have been very reluctant and drag their feet on.
And Roger, I think that's such an important point, because we have a school that had been surveying the kids and finding out that, you know, hundreds of girls were interested in lacrosse. And then what they would do is they would hold one meeting and they would say, okay, well, only five girls came, not going to offer lacrosse this year. And then they'd survey and they'd find another 100 girls interested, and then they'd do the same thing. And then year after year, girls learned there was never going to be a lacrosse team, yet they still were expressing an interest on the survey. So I think it is hard for schools to expand. I know this difficult budget time for public schools, but But really, it's so important to be responding to these emerging interests for girls. And you have to be either expanding your existing teams or adding new teams in order to make sure that you are on the sunny side of Title IX.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think... Go ahead.
And those same surveys may also tell you that, boy, our numbers are dropping in this area, and maybe that's not the needs of our kids in our community anymore. And we can look at, instead of having three baseball teams, that maybe we really only need two. I mean, the surveys, it's your shopping list. It's your roadmap of what your future needs to look like. And so those surveys are so important to help guide where you're going.
Right, and every generation of kids is going to be different from the one that came before. Yeah, and another interesting, because I think it's important for people to realize that the impact of sports is so much bigger than just that playing time. And one thing I read somewhere was that girls who play high school sports are 40% more likely to graduate from college. There's another, you know, that's a huge impact that's going to have a lifelong change for a young girl.
There's also important information about health benefits for girls and employment outcomes mm-hmm. for girls. And so this is really an important part of our organization's mission because we really see participation in athletics as a pathway to future employment.
Yeah, and probably lifelong health and all kinds of other things, too,
exactly.
Like you mentioned. Well, we are getting close to the end of our hour. I wanted to give you all a chance to kind of give some closing remarks. And maybe when you sort of share with us maybe any parting thoughts, you could reflect a little bit as we started talking about this broader vision of Title IX and the places that Title IX hasn't quite touched yet around participation. And Elizabeth mentioned the law school and in college degrees, women have made unbelievable amounts of progress. In fact, get more undergraduate degrees now than men do. But there's still really gaps in areas like science and technology, engineering and math, and places that women really are still kind of left out of the equation to a large extent. So none of you are exactly experts on that part of the law, but I, as you close out with us, maybe just any reflections you have on that. So would you like to start, Marlene? Or
yeah, I'm happy to start.
Thank you.
I mean, I really see that this STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, is an important frontier, and there are a number of groups that are working on this issue. Marlene mentioned AAUW, the American Association of University Women, and they put out a report called Why So Few? And it's really trying to look systematically at what are the barriers to women participating in these fields. And there was just a great story in the paper a couple of weeks ago about women here in Silicon Valley who are starting a toy company that's supposed to be providing interesting toys for girls that also are going to teach them things about engineering mm-hmm. And teach them things. And so I think it's really about making some deep cultural shifts and changes. And I think we have to be, you know, using all of our resources to do that because women need to be participating in all of these fields. We need women's contributions.
That's a great point. And to look at it starts with girls, just like with Bossy. Yeah.
You know, in Bossy, we always say that with opportunity comes the responsibility to pay it forward. And I think that goes beyond the sports world. Every female athlete who has had the opportunity and the privilege of playing sports has a responsibility to think about the next generation of girls. But so do those women who benefited from Title IX in the science and technology realm. And they need to also be thinking about what it means for a little girl to say, if I can see her, I can be her, and find ways of being that role model for them.
That's a great point. And we're running out of time here. Carrie or Roger, do you have any closing thoughts for us briefly?
My only closing thought for your listeners is whenever they hear all the things about Title IX, just remember your sons and daughters, and we treat them the same. You know, they have different interests, okay. But bottom line, we treat our sons and daughters the same. That's how we do it at home. We need to do it in our school.
Thank you, Roger. I want to thank you for joining us. We had a great conversation with Roger Blake, Marlene Bornsrud, Carrie Dew, and Elizabeth Kristen tonight about Title IX. Thank you for joining me. For a link to this and other City Vision show, visit KLW and search for City Visions. Our engineer tonight was Kevin Vance. Thank you, Kevin. Tonight's show was produced by me with in-studio help from Susie Britton, who's also our senior producer. Thank you, Susie. This is Victoria Thorpe. Thanks for listening to City Visions on KALW, your local public radio station. Good night and have a great week.